From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. In terms both good and ill, conservatism is on many minds these days, in politics, social issues, and in the academy. What are the historical and philosophical origins of modern conservatism? What do adherents as well as critics say about those origins? Soundings put those questions to a group of scholars at the National Humanities Center. The conversation that follows is the first segment in a series of discussions about modern conservatism, with special reference to Edmund Burke, the 18th century British statesman and orator viewed by many scholars as one of the founders of modern conservatism. The speakers are Harvey Mansfield, Joseph Hamburger, Louis Lipsitz, and Paul Kress. Harvey Mansfield is a professor of government at Harvard University. As a scholar at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a book about theories of executive power. Joseph Hamburger teaches political science at Yale University. Louis Lipsitz and Paul Kress are professors of political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here is Harvey Mansfield.
Edmund Burke was the first conservative, I think one could say. He himself didn't use the word. The word conservative is a 19th century word, which is a correlative of liberal. You didn't have a conservative until you had a liberal. Burke, though he didn't use the word, was the first and most important reactor to the French Revolution. Liberalism is, at least originally, a revolutionary doctrine. Later on in the 19th century, acquired a more reformist aspect or practice, and even in the original thinkers of liberalism, especially Locke, there was no desire to set cities burning. But the principles were in themselves always revolutionary. They required a critique, a fundamental critique of existing social practices.
I would like to suggest that, well, what Harvey says, of course, is correct about Burke reacting against the French Revolution and all revolution, the idea of revolution. In addition, I think one can regard, wouldn't you agree, that one can regard Burke as reacting against a body of thought, an implication of which was the very idea of continuous change, what might be called and what was called progress. And in that sense, Burke's conservatism consists not only of an opposition to revolution, but to an understanding of society and politics that made revolution possible and even desirable. In that understanding of politics, one might say that revolution represented the quickest step, the most rapid move in the direction of some ideal of society. And in that sense, Burke's conservatism consists of more than a politician's reaction to a particular event, but also a philosopher's reaction to a whole body of thought.
Liberal principles required a new plan or a total remaking of society. That plan might come quickly, or it might be put into practice quickly, or it might come slowly. But the plan itself was revolutionary.
Let me interject something about this connected with liberalism and conservatism and the heritage of the 18th century. I think one of our heritages, like it or not, is connected somewhat with a belief in progress, is the feeling that we can't avoid as a society and as thinkers about society, considering the possibilities of progress, the possibilities of change, dealing in some more or less reasonable way with the problems, difficulties, grievances, and the growth and change of society, the kinds of societies we live in, so different, I think, from the society of 200 years ago. And this is one of the reasons, I think, that it's a bit of a dilemma deciding what part of the conservative tradition is, I would say, thoroughly dated or outdated, and what part of it can be made relevant in modern life. That is, we've lived in societies that especially over the last 200 years, have moved so quickly, changed so fast, far beyond, I think, what any 18th century thinker would have imagined, or for that matter, even most of the 19th century thinkers. And the result of this is our thinking and our capacity to cope with social change is barely keeps up, I think, most of the time with the realities of social change. Now, that's a fact, I think, that liberals try to deal with by saying, well, this is sort of the natural state of society. Society naturally changes and evolves, and, you know, hopefully that's mainly in a progressive, quote, progressive or good direction. Well, we have to direct it some way. But the problem of directing change, of dealing with change, it seems to me to be just one of the perennial, inevitable facts of modern life, and I don't believe it was recognized as such 200 years ago. I think people, Burke included, thought that change in the sense we understand it was far from inevitable, and in fact, in the basics of life, it was possible to prevent change from occurring almost altogether.
If I may interject, Burke did make the statement that a constitution without the means of change is without the means of its own preservation. And that makes it clear, I think.
Conservation, in fact.
Yes. There's the
connection to conservative. Yes.
But it's an interesting juxtaposition of the very notion of conserving with change. In other words, his conservatism was not a stick-in-the-mud conservatism. It was not did not involve the idea that one must maintain the status quo, as people say. On the contrary, he assumed that in order to preserve the essential values of a society, it was necessary to alter the institutions that would provide an environment in which those values could be sustained and in which they could attract conviction. And so I would, if I may pursue what might be a disagreement here, I would suggest that Burke assumed the inevitability of change, and that his understanding of conservatism was one that that proposed that change take place at a certain pace and in certain ways in order to adjust the ever-changing technologies and conditions of life while at the same time preserving the essential values that are worth preserving in a society and in a tradition.
If I could defend my position just a little bit without, I don't think we're totally in disagreement. I think the things you say about Burke are quite right. But I think for Burke, as for most conservatives, there are sharp limits to what they regard as legitimate change. I think many of the things that have happened in the last 200 years would have been quite repulsive to Burke. The main thing, I think, being the democratization of life in Western societies. I think this there are some many conservatives who still have great difficulty adjusting to this or accepting it or thinking that it was the right way for society to evolve. And I think
Lou is right in suggesting that Burke might have been very surprised if he were to see what life was like today, what our political and social life is like today. He did assume the, as everyone in his time did, and indeed as our founding fathers did, the existence of a hierarchical society. The notion of a society being classless would have I suppose appalled him. On the other hand, I do recall a passage in his Reflections on the French Revolution in which he says that even a democratic society is conceivable, and by implication, I think acceptable. But the main thing I would say in response to what Lewis said is that the essential part of Burke's teaching, it seems to me, concentrates on some understanding as to how one should conduct politics, and that's an understanding that puts great emphasis upon what Burke called prudence, which for him I think meant taking into account circumstances and adjusting to them, and doing the best you can within the context of given circumstances. And for that reason, I would suggest that Burke's teaching is still very relevant today, because he would have appreciated the problems we have, which were very similar to his, where we face novel circumstances, one might say revolutionary circumstances, as he did with the French Revolution, and he would have urged us to consider his proposals as to how one should deal with them.
I think here there is a difference that we were touching on before, and that's related maybe even to this idea of prudential politics, because I think in general liberals have a far, and radicals more so, have a far more optimistic idea about human nature and the possibilities of extensive and favorable, sensible social change working out reasonably well and reasonably fast.
In view of some of the events that have occurred in the 20th century, I'm wondering whether or not Burke's more dismal view of human nature was not the more correct one.
Well, I think it's right.
Consider the Holocaust, the tens of millions of people who have been sacrificed to the pursuit of communism in the Soviet Union, to consider what's going on in Cambodia and elsewhere. I would have thought Burke's view of human nature is borne out, not wrong.
I don't know about his view of human nature, but I think the view of politics certainly is borne out. That is that whether or not that you have to go back to it, change your views of human nature or not, maybe we can talk about it after a while, but maybe that's so too. But I think if the Bolshevik Revolution had worked out differently, if it had worked out the way, let's say, the very optimistic people thought it might at the time, or if the other kinds of things that you mentioned, 20th century, the horrors of the 20th century hadn't occurred.
Had they read Burke, they would have understood that it couldn't have worked out in the optimistic way, in a satisfactory way.
I wonder if we could come back for a moment to a point that Wayne has asked us about and that Harvey, I think, began with. Some years ago, Sam Huntington wrote an article in which he argued that conservatism really was what he called, I think, a positional ideology. That is, it had really no kind of content. And here we're inclined to, I think, talk about Burke's view of human nature and so on. But Huntington suggested then that it was simply a reaction. And I wonder, Harvey, whether you would accept that. That is, Huntington argued that it was a mistake for us to try to read conservatism back into Aristotle, say. But there was no content to it, I think.
Burke's conservatism, I think, begins as a reaction, or can first be understood as a reaction. Whether it is a purely empty or formal thing, I very much doubt, however. I think there are some substantial principles about human nature which have to underlie a reaction to liberal principles and to their revolutionary expression. So some kind of pessimistic view of the way men behave when suddenly given a terrific amount of power. Oh, people who are inexperienced, who have never been used to wielding power will, Burke thought, and perhaps the events of the French Revolution and many other revolutions since bear him out, he thought would become tyrannical and go to pieces, carry their positions to a terrific extreme.
Yes, but what I hear about the table now is a definition of Burke's position in terms of prudence, say, or a prudential politics. But
it's not the sole content of his position, but it's a very prominent part of it, I would think.
Yeah. Well, but prudence, after all, is a kind of moral concept, isn't it? And it operates only given an institutional context. A kind of constitutional history such as the British enjoyed. What are you prudent in?
It's difficult to imagine politics ever taking place in the absence of an institutional context. I would have thought that context need not be that of the British constitutional tradition. Surely there's a need for prudential politics, wherever politics is taking place.
It seems that underneath prudence there must be a view of human nature which makes prudence necessary, which makes it impossible to dismiss prudence. Prudence would seem to be acting in politics without a rule or without a law, doing what's best in the circumstances, not always knowing beforehand. One of the main things Burke has to teach us is prudence. Burke thought that prudence was very important because its role was being misunderstood and diminished in the new revolutionary theories and in the practitioners of these theories. He thought that political theory is one thing and political practice or prudence is another. Political theory tends to be based on the extreme case. Political practice has to be based on the average or normal case. Political theory tries to predict what's going to happen. Political practice realizes that chance events make such predictions impossible or very difficult. Political theory presupposes that we are detached from something. Political practice presupposes that you are necessarily involved in what you are doing, and that what happens will affect you. Political theory presupposes that truth is timeless, and your opinions are reversible. Political practice is concerned with here and now, not with timeless universals. And in political practice, it's not so easy to reverse yourself. If President Reagan tries to reverse himself instead of stay the course, he can lose his support and be regarded as weak. And last, perhaps, political theory is a matter of private opinion, of the opinion of a speculator, of a theorist, whereas political practice has to do with the opinions of the public.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the first segment in a series of conversations about the nature, development, and criticism of modern conservatism in politics, history, and philosophy. The speakers in this portion of the discussion are Louis Lipsitz, Joseph Hamburger, and Harvey Mansfield. Louis Lipsitz teaches political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Joseph Hamburger is a professor of political science at Yale University. While on a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Harvey Mansfield worked on a book about the theory of executive power. He's a professor of government at Harvard University. Here is Louis Lipsitz.
I was going to make a little comment on theory and practice, and I remembered the economist John Maynard Keynes' comment about how the hard-headed businessman of one day who thinks he's just being a practical man, I'm not sure practical and prudent are quite the same, but anyway, he thinks he's being practical, is really living in the thrall of the ideas of some economist of two generations before. In other words, what we think of as a hard-headed prudential politics of the moment may in fact simply reflect, be the unreflective activity based on ideas that we've kind of inherited and that are part of our, what in fact Burke calls our prejudices. And the danger, I think this shows the danger of prudential politics. That is, the danger of it is that it doesn't look beyond the current context. It assumes that all the problems that one faces can be resolved within the context that already exists. In other words, the prudential politics is usually a politics that doesn't seek to change the fundamental dimensions of the political arena or of the basic political structures.
That's right.
And that's its strength, and at the same time, that's its weakness.
That I think is quite fair. It does not look at the long run. I wouldn't say it looks only at the short term, but at the intermediate term as well, but not much beyond that. This, however, seems to me is not so much a weakness in as much as as if I may quote Keynes again, I think it was he who said, in the long run, we're all dead. Mm-hmm. And for yeah. those of us who want to continue living, and this is eminently true of most persons with political responsibilities, they ought to look at the short and intermediate term, and therefore I would have thought that even Keynes would see the desirability of their be acting prudentially sure. in Burke's sense.
Sure, that's a good point. The long run, as Joe was saying, is made up of many short runs. But
I didn't say that, but I wish I had.
Don't we sometimes have to take a longer view? And there, I think Lou's question is very much to the point. Is it possible to rely simply on prudence mm-hmm. as a guide to politics? To rely simply on doing what is best here and now in these circumstances, or do you need some more long-range guide? Which would also be a guide for your prudence. Does prudence need a guide?
What would Burke say about that?
Burke would, I think, try to go as far as one can without such a guide. Because his main objection, again, to the revolutionaries was that they brought the long run into the short run.
Not people in general, but when people get power with utopian ideas as to how they ought to use that power, ideas that suggest to them that they ought to try to remedy all the ills of society and of human nature at one go. And I think that's the kind of use of power that Burke was most worried about.
I mean, it's a radical social transformation, really. The attempt is kind of a coerced one from the top, I guess.
Indeed.
With a fairly small number of people. I mean, the kinds of things we've seen, what would nowadays you'd call Leninist, kind of a Leninist, although maybe it wasn't just Lenin. I mean, maybe you can see the same thing in the Nazi regime in a way, too.
Indeed, and I would suggest also in Iran under the Khomeini, mm-hmm. the attempt to transform society and radically alter the way people live, all in the name of some higher value which some persons in the society believe in, but which many do not.
Burke's writing on the French Revolution. He wrote very early on in the course of the revolution, and when you read his reflections on the revolution, there are so many astounding insights, I think, about the likely course of that revolution, which he was, you know, seeing events further down the road, the kinds of things the revolution consuming its own children, the development of the terror. The whole process of social change just sort of galloping out of anybody's control, and all kinds of wild and crazy ideas and
yes,
fanatical
also,
people
also
taking
the,
over.
The possibility of a Napoleon.
Yes, and in the end, what happens? I mean, you establish in place of the old king, you have now a new emperor. So, I mean, what in a way, what was really accomplished? But see, there's no question to me in reading Burke. There's a wealth of I would call it a kind of sad insight, but sad if you have any sympathy with revolutionary change, tremendous insight about the problems of tearing a social order apart and then not thinking clearly and understanding what if anything, you can put in its place. But the question that I wonder is whether Burke's position to the revolution, the French Revolution, itself, other than being a criticism of revolutionary politics in general of this sort, whether it does give us enough insight into the antidote to those politics. That is, we can say prudence, but once, you see, we're living nowadays in a time where there are so many people who believe in revolutionary change. There have been so many revolutions of different kinds that you wonder whether the recommendation of a more prudential politics, a politics that recognizes limits, really is the kind of thing that kind of insight really can now make any difference when once revolution has itself become such a popular idea.
Right. Are you suggesting that it's a popular idea and an inevitable one, that societies do not have choice as to whether they will pursue a revolutionary course of action or one that is perhaps more slow-paced, more moderate?
No, I think I mean, just to talk about left-wing revolution for a minute, it seems, if, for example, if we look at Central America, this is, I mean, getting very terribly contemporary, but, and elsewhere, the Chinese Revolution and so on, I mean, these were people, all of whom thought that very radical social transformation was possible. And it, of course, it is possible, but it's possible at a very high price in the way it's currently conducted. And I wonder whether, it seems to me useless to say to these people, abstain from revolutionary politics, because that simply isn't going to happen. That is, it seems to me in the modern world there are going to be revolutionaries in revolutionary politics. And from the conservative point of view, maybe that's regrettable. But I'm wondering whether some of the insights of someone like Burke about revolutionary politics couldn't be brought to bear in a way that would be that would make sense to people who think about revolution.
Well, I think they can, and I would not assume that the alternative to revolutionary politics is only the politics of standing still. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that there's more than one kind of conservatism, and it seems to me that Burke would endorse the kind of conservatism that urges change, but change of a particular kind, change that is moderate, change that builds that seeks consent amongst a majority of a populace for the changes that are to take place, and a change that would not require the coercion of the entire society in the pursuit of certain ideals. So, going back to Central America, it seems to me that Burke would have been sympathetic with the kind of change that seeks a middle course, that he would not necessarily lend his support to those who want to resist all change and go backward.
But is it enough to say, be prudent? Is that a sufficient slogan for conservatism of Burke's day or today either? Don't you need some more fundamental principle to counteract or to counter the liberal principle or the revolutionary principle?
Perhaps you do, but I'm wondering what you would say those principles are for Burke.
Yeah,
I think I know what you would say what they are for us. But what you think Burke was the kind of conservative who did go beyond an idea of prudential politics?
I think he did, but with reluctance. He went with prudence, I think, as far as he could. But when he reached the limit, because there is a limit, prudence isn't enough, because you do finally need a theory to counteract the other fellow's theory. And what Lou said is right, that prudence is somehow connected or wrapped up in theory.
Well, there
and needs the guidance of sound theory and not simply to be separated from all theory.
You've been listening to the first segment in a series of conversations about modern conservatism in politics, history and philosophy, and critical theory. The program is Soundings from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The speakers were Harvey Mansfield, Joseph Hamburger, Louis Lipsitz, and Paul Kress. Harvey Mansfield teaches government at Harvard University. At the National Humanities Center, he worked on a book about theories of executive power. Joseph Hamburger is a professor of political science at Yale University. Louis Lipsitz and Paul Kress teach political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities.